particular note in the chorus of light, while some of the variables covered a wide range of several octaves. Miss Leavitt could still think in musical terms, even as the sound of music faded from her perception. She continued every Sunday at church to sing the hymns that had filled her childhood. First in Lancaster, Massachusetts, where she was born on the 4th of July, 1868, and later in Cleveland, where the family moved when her father, the Reverend Dr. George Roswell Leavitt, became pastor of that city's Plymouth Congregational Church. In Ohio, she spent her 17th year enrolled at the Oberlin Conservatory of Music, before the onset of her hearing problems diverted her course. After conservatory, as a student of liberal arts at coeducational Oberlin College, and all through her 4 years of women's college in Cambridge, she excelled at mathematics, from algebra to geometry to calculus. Pickering found Miss Leavitt to be of an extremely quiet and retiring nature, absorbed in her work to an unusual degree. Nevertheless, he asked her, in February 1896, to introduce the newcomer, Miss Cannon, to the variable stars near the pole. Miss Cannon would also be examining them, not during the daytime on photographs, but nightly by telescope, as the first female assistant ever commissioned to do so. The 32-year-old Miss Cannon owed this privilege to her educational lineage. At Wellesley, she had studied physics with Pickering's MIT protege, Sarah Frances Whiting, in a program of hands-on laboratory instruction modeled on the methods he innovated. Miss Cannon had also taken Professor Whiting's astronomy course, which taught her how to handle Wellesley's 4-inch Browning telescope and kept her abreast of activities at the Harvard College Observatory. When the great comet of 1882 arrived like a white-winged bird in the autumn of Miss Cannon's junior year, Miss Whiting supervised observations of its flight over a period of months. For nearly a week, the object flared brightly enough to catch the naked eye, even in daylight. But only the telescope could disclose how the comet nucleus broke into pieces after its close brush with the sun. Miss Cannon might have followed a quicker trajectory from Wellesley to Harvard, but the lingering effects of scarlet fever grounded her at home in Dover, Delaware. After graduation, she took up photography, tutored small groups of students in arithmetic and American history, and made the rafters ring, as she put it, playing the organ for Sunday school at the Methodist Church. A pleasant decade passed in this fashion, until her mother's death plunged her into despair. "I'm still here in my little room, surrounded by my memories," she wrote in her diary on March 4th, 1894. Nearly 3 months after the funeral of Mary Elizabeth Jump Cannon. "My mother is ever before me. I can see how people lose their minds, for I believe I shall if I am not aroused by something. She was mine and always will be my most precious mother. 12 weeks ago tonight, she was downstairs in the spare room and was more worried about my taking a nap on my couch without covering than about herself. She said she knew I was going to be sick, for I looked so. And here I am after 12 weeks of agony, such as I shall never have to pass through again. Here I am well. My constitution will carry me through many weary years, yet may I be led into a useful, busy life. I am not afraid of work. I long for it. What can it be?" Just as Mrs. Draper had taken solace in founding the memorial project at Harvard after the loss of her husband, so Miss Cannon found a way through her grief by participating in that project. She returned to Wellesley in 1894 as assistant to Miss Whiting, who smoothed her transition to Searle's practical research class at Radcliffe and a perch in the observatory. Soon it will be 97, and 3 years have passed, Miss Cannon noted at 11:15 p.m. on December 31st, 1896, picking up her diary again after a long hiatus. "Two busy years at Wellesley and this one at the Harvard Observatory. The busy life I so longed for has been opened up to me. Friends have come to me from the great world, and my heart, my life, are now the study of astronomy. They little know what it means to me, how it was the only thread holding my reason, almost my life. I no longer look forward with dread. The days have no terror. I long for my mother just the same, but I feel that I have the patience to run my race, to do the work set before me, and am able to find contentment in my surroundings. I could not help it, thrown as I am with such kind people. Her colleague, Miss Leavitt, had taken advantage of a travel opportunity and left the observatory, at least temporarily, but Miss Cannon still counted 18 fellow female and 21 male associates in her new professional family. At night, when weather permitted, she did what had been considered man's work. She used the 6-inch telescope in the observatory's west wing to check on the variables assigned to her, noting the date and hour of each magnitude appraisal she made. Over time, such isolated glimpses would add up to a star's full cycle of variation, or light curve, from maximum to minimum and back to maximum brightness. The curve, in turn, could suggest the type of variation, and perhaps hint at the cause as well. Whenever Miss Cannon felt unable even to estimate a magnitude, she recorded the reason, such as C for cloudy, or M if bright moonlight impeded her task. Daylight hours found her at a light lectern, alongside the women in the computing room, examining photographic plates from Arequipa. Miss Cannon's allotted niche in the Henry Draper Memorial concerned the spectra of the brightest southern stars. The director wanted her to create a southern counterpart to Miss Morey's classification of the bright stars of the north. The 13-inch Boyden telescope in Peru provided Miss Cannon with the same kind of widely dispersed, highly detailed spectra that the 11-inch Draper telescope had produced for Miss Morey. She could see and appreciate, in the forests of several hundred dark and bright lines, the patterns that had led Miss Morey to develop her complex but coherent system. And yet, Mrs. Fleming's hydrogen line alphabet also evinced logic, insight, and internal consistency. One approach focused on the overall pattern of spectral lines, the other emphasized the thickness or thinness of individual lines. Each arranged the stars in a different order. Miss Cannon stirred the two approaches in her mind as she parsed the starlight of the nether hemisphere. When Catherine Bruce saw the evidence from Peru of her telescope's prowess, she thanked Pickering 1,000 times, no, many thousand times, for each star on those truly extraordinary plates. She had not seen the actual glass plates, but rather photographic prints that Pickering made from them as gifts to her. They portrayed Solon Bailey's bountiful stellar clusters, captured by the giant telescope's all-seeing eye. Miss Bruce pronounced them most wonderful productions. It tickled her, she said, to be for once in the position of recipient, with Professor Pickering as the donor. Meanwhile, her own donor activity continued unabated. Requests reached her from astronomers everywhere, and she responded as Pickering advised. To Max Wolf of Heidelberg, the man who had made the first discovery of an asteroid by photography, and named that body Brucia in her honor, she gave $10,000 for a new telescope. As a charter subscriber to George Ellery Hale's magazine, The Astrophysical Journal, Miss Bruce provided the $1,000 required to set the struggling publishing venture on firm financial ground. In 1897, Pickering approached Miss Bruce on behalf of the Young Astronomical Society of the Pacific, entreating her to endow a gold medal as special recognition for lifelong achievement by an individual researcher. In agreeing to establish such an award fund, Miss Bruce stipulated that her medal, like her grants, should go only to the truly deserving, irrespective of nationality. She also thought it would be a grand thing to see the medal bestowed someday on a woman, and added that possibility to the eligibility criteria. Citizens of any country, persons of either sex. As for the rest, she wished Pickering would arrange the whole affair. She was past the age of 80 now, tired and often ill. She relied more and more on her sister to keep up her astronomy correspondence. Pickering, along with two other directors of U.S. observatories and three from Europe, submitted nominations for the first Bruce medalist. The Astronomical Society's board of directors settled easily on the foremost American astronomer, the already much-decorated Dean of Celestial Mechanics, Simon Newcomb of the U.S. Nautical Almanac Office, whom they considered a philosopher as well as an astronomer and a mathematician. Newcomb had supervised recalculation and tabulation of orbital elements for all the planets, and also improved the efficacy of several astronomical formulas by arriving at new values for fundamental constants, which were adopted by institutions the world over. Miss Bruce, who traced her active support of astronomical research to Newcomb's 1888 article in the Sidereal Messenger, approved the choice. Newcomb had changed his view of future prospects in astronomy. Now that her grants supported two of his computing projects, he called on her whenever his travels took him to New York. "I like Newcomb decidedly," Miss Bruce confided to Pickering. "But I believe I like all the astronomers whom I know." She had become a magnet for them. Pickering remained her special favorite, however, and his Arequipa telescope her most generous gift. Within the Bruce telescope's first few months of operation in Peru, it produced photographic charts of the entire southern sky. These images at once supplemented and augmented the existing southern star catalogs. The Uranometria Argentina of 1879, for example, listed the position and brightness of 7,756 stars to the limit of seventh magnitude. A single Bruce exposure of 3 hours' duration collected the light of as many as 400,000 stars, some as faint as 15th magnitude. Pickering offered glass copies of our negatives to all interested astronomers, to be used as source material for any number of important investigations. The Bruce telescope saw, as no predecessor ever had before, into the hearts of the southern star clusters and nebulae that Bailey loved to explore. In the spring of 1897, he asked Pickering official permission to pursue the variable stars in clusters or elsewhere which I have or may discover. Bailey predicted his proposed study of such stars' periods might occupy his spare time for many years, during which he would always welcome the director's assistance and advice. Pickering approved the plan, without foreseeing its potential as a source of friction between his two camps. Since Bailey had specified variable stars, which I have or may discover, he became increasingly concerned with their discovery. He and his assistants, Delisle Stewart and William Clymer, began checking each night's images to pick out the possible variables before shipping the plates to Cambridge. Soon, Mrs. Fleming complained. "She feels," Pickering explained to Bailey on September 29, 1897, "that in these cases, the credit goes to the Peruvian observers while a large amount of work falls upon her. She is obliged to measure the positions, the variations in brightness, if any, and to identify the individual lines, classify the object, and see if it is a catalog star. She also has to re-examine the plates, since the fainter objects, including about half of the peculiar objects, and as many more having slight peculiarities, are omitted from the existing catalogs. All of this is part of her regular routine work and has been for the past 10 years, and much of it could not be done in Peru. On the other hand," Pickering conceded, "Dr. Stewart would doubtless feel aggrieved if, after all the labor, especially in following the Bruce plates, he is not allowed to examine them. The delay might also prevent the early discovery of a new star or other object of special interest. Bailey, for his part, sympathized with Mrs. Fleming's vexation, but thought it unfair to deny credit for producing first-class plates while publicly recognizing the mere picking up of new objects by certain well-known characteristics. Here, Pickering had to agree, and he promised to change observatory policy accordingly. From now on, individual assistants who demonstrated special skill or care in photography would indeed receive proper acknowledgement in Harvard announcements. Miss Morey had often feared she might not receive credit for the years of effort she invested in her classification system. But in 1897, when her Spectra of Bright Stars was published in the annals of the Harvard College Observatory, Antonia C. Morey stood out in bold black and white, right on the title page, above the name of Edward C. Pickering, director. It marked the first time that a woman had authored any part of the annals. In 1890, in contrast, the contributions of Mrs. M. Fleming to the Draper Catalog of Stellar Spectra had been described and gratefully acknowledged only in the director's introductory remarks. Pickering's preface to the new volume noted that Miss Morey had been assigned in 1888 to study the spectra of the bright northern stars as part of the Henry Draper Memorial, and she is alone responsible for the classification. Given that her investigations had been made several years prior, he said they predated the recent discoveries respecting the spectrum of helium. Rather than rewrite the lengthy treatise in the light of helium, Miss Morey had appended a discussion and some new thoughts in 6 pages of supplementary notes. After her return from Europe in 1895, Miss Morey retreated to the old Draper homestead in Hastings-on-Hudson, where her mother had grown up. The domes of her Uncle Henry's telescopes now stood empty at the top of the hill, but the several cottages on the property still belonged to her elderly great-aunt, Dorothy Catherine Draper. Miss Morey found work in nearby Tarrytown-on-Hudson, teaching chemistry and physics at Miss C.E. Mason's Suburban School for Girls. Nostalgia carried Miss Morey back to Vassar, also nearby in Poughkeepsie, for the astronomy department's annual dome party. In her college days, she had studied under Mariah Mitchell, the first lady of American astronomy, who instituted the dome parties and the practice of asking all the student guests to write poems on scraps of paper. Miss Morey felt inspired to revive that tradition. Her 1896 Verses to the Vassar Dome began, "A low-built tower and olden, dingy but dear to the sight, and they that dwell therein are wont to watch the stars at night." The late Professor Mitchell had been just under 30 when she attained world fame and a gold medal from the King of Denmark for her 1847 discovery of Miss Mitchell's Comet. Miss Morey had herself only recently turned 30, but her career seemed to be veering away from astronomy. Perhaps her publication in the annals would steer it back in the direction she intended years earlier when, "With searching glass I scanned those far deep lanes of night, where stars well up through endlessness in springs of living light." Pickering invited Miss Morey briefly back to Harvard in mid-August 1898 to speak about her early research at a collegial meeting of distinguished astronomers intent on forming a national professional society. Everyone came, from Simon Newcomb, the elder statesman of the science, to 30-year-old George Ellery Hale. Hale, who so successfully organized the country's first astronomy meeting in Chicago in the summer of 1893, had hosted another one in 1897, at the dedication of the grand new Yerkes Observatory in Williams Bay, Wisconsin, where he was now director. His arrival in Cambridge in 1898 coincided with a severe heat wave that lasted throughout the 3-day gathering. Pickering's welcome proved equally warm. As the attendees were too numerous to be accommodated en masse in the observatory, The director ushered all 100-plus of them into the parlor of his home. The spacious mansion of Professor Pickering formed an ideal place for the meeting of a convention. Writer Harriet Richardson Donahue reported in Popular Astronomy, while the gracious dignity of the director and the hospitality of his stately wife, who received their guests with a cordial greeting, gave the serious purpose of the assemblage a touch of festivity and saved even the non-scientist from feeling out of his element. Miss Donahue herself was one of the few non-scientists present. The situation called to her mind Walt Whitman's poem about the learned astronomer, and she quoted part of a line from it in her article. Charts and diagrams to add, divide, and measure gave evidence of the heavy work laid out for the savants. But behind them gleamed the snowy outlines of the bust of some honored ancestor, the rich coloring of a family portrait, or the sparkle of a jeweled miniature in the artistic setting of a private drawing room. Members of Harvard's own observatory staff peopled the roster of speakers, beginning with Professor Searle, who delivered a talk on the personal equation, or the way an individual observer's visual acuity, eye-hand coordination, and speed of reaction affected his perceptions. Mrs. Fleming prepared an announcement of the numerous new variables with bright hydrogen lines found on Bruce and Bache telescope plates from Arequipa. The director read her paper aloud at the podium, adding a coda of his own. As Miss Donahue reported, in conclusion, Professor Pickering said that Mrs. Fleming had omitted to mention that of these 79 stars, nearly all had been discovered by herself. Whereupon Mrs. Fleming was compelled by a spontaneous burst of applause to come forward and supplement the paper by responding to the questions elicited by it. Later, Solon Bailey, only recently returned from his 5-year tour of duty in Peru, discussed his pet subject, variable stars in clusters. And at the end, Miss Maury held forth on the K-lines of Beta Aurigae. A coterie of participants, including Newcomb and Hale, met privately with Pickering to define the National Astronomical Society and draft its constitution. They did all that in a single day, though they could not settle on a name. By the time the members of the nascent organization dispersed to their home institutions, the entire astronomy community knew that an important new solar system body had come to light in Europe. Gustav Witt of the Urania Observatory in Berlin and Auguste Charlois at Nice were both out hunting asteroids with telescope and camera when they picked up the object's trail on the night of August 13, 1898. Max Wolf's detection of Brucia in 1891 had proven the superiority of photography for such pursuits. On a plate exposed for 2 hours or more, a fast-moving asteroid would stand out as a very short line against the backdrop of the distant point-like stars. Upon developing their plates, both Witt and Charlois detected the same small streak of evidence. But Witt filed the first claim, with the result that other astronomers joining the chase in the following days referred to the quarry as Witt's planet. The newfound body quickly distinguished itself as the speediest of its kind, and therefore bound to pass nearer to Earth than any of the others. Seth Carlo Chandler, a specialist in defining the orbits of comets and asteroids, rushed to determine the true path of Witt's planet. Once he had worked out a preliminary ephemeris, or table of its predicted positions, from the current spate of sightings, he estimated that the object, now barely discernible at 11th magnitude, probably had whistled close by Earth in 1894. No one noticed it then, but Chandler hoped a trace of its passage might be preserved on one or more photographic plates in the unique astronomical archive of the Harvard College Observatory. He would need to smooth over his earlier dispute with the director over the Harvard photometry to gain access to the glass universe. "I deem it my duty, in the interest of science," Chandler wrote to Pickering on November 3, 1898, to send you the enclosed ephemeris of the planet, which all astronomers will be interested in common, for the recovery of any previous observations of this most important body. Pickering, of course, assented, and directed Mrs. Fleming to search through the plate stacks. With Chandler's rough map in hand, she selected the likeliest photographs among the 100,000 in storage, and spent months combing through them for signs of Vitt's planet. In early January 1899, on plates dated 1893, she finally found the elongated blob that she took to be the asteroid and measured its positions. Chandler then incorporated the additional data into a corrected orbit, which he sent back to her. Armed with the improved map, Mrs. Fleming once again located the object, which had been named Eros in the interim on plates from 1894 and 1896. "I thought the asteroids were always feminine," Miss Bruce exclaimed when she heard the news. And it was true that all 432 previous discoveries, beginning with the first one, Ceres, in 1801, had been given women's names. "Fortunately, poor dear little Eros is so far from the rest," she added, "or his life might be made miserable among all those old maids. It is pleasant that you photographed him so long ago, while he was yet happy, unknown to fame." Mrs. Draper wrote to say she was glad the ever-growing trove of photographs had cornered Eros, noting, "The small god himself could scarcely have been more troublesome." Chandler agreed. He thought Pluto a more suitable name than Eros for the asteroid, for malignity alone. As Chandler redefined Eros's orbit around the sun, he predicted the asteroid would come to pass very near Earth in the autumn of 1900. At that close range, Eros might be pressed to answer the oldest riddle in astronomy. What is the distance between Earth and the sun? The remoteness of the heavenly bodies made their distances all but impossible to gauge. The most the ancients could say was that the planets must be closer than the stars, since the planets, or wanderers, could be seen moving with respect to the stars, while the constellations ever maintained their same configurations. In the 3rd century BC, Aristarchus of Samos judged the relative remove of the sun and the moon by geometry, concluding that the sun was probably 20 times farther away than the moon. In the 1500s, when Copernicus proposed the planets circled the sun and not Earth, he estimated the relative distances between these bodies. Jupiter, for example, must lie 5.2 times farther than Earth from the sun, and Venus only a fraction, 0.72, of Earth's solar distance. But Copernicus still had no idea how far away to place the stars, nor could Kepler, who derived the laws of planetary motion in the early 1600s, offer more than relative proportions for the distances separating the members of the solar system. Determining the true width of a single interplanetary gap would define all the others at a stroke, and a firm figure for the Earth-Sun distance would constitute a crucial milestone en route to the stars. An opportunity to define the much-desired Earth-Sun distance, or astronomical unit, arose late in the 18th century, on the occasion of the 1761 transit of Venus. Twice in about 100 years, the orbits of Earth and Venus allow the sister planet to be seen crossing the face of the sun over a period of several hours. English astronomer Royal Edmund Halley foresaw the phenomenon's potential for resolving the distance dilemma. He imagined observers venturing far to the north and south of the globe to watch the transit and record the exact times of its various stages. The wide geographical separation between the observing parties would cause each to see Venus transit the sun at a slightly different solar latitude. Later, by comparing their notes and triangulating, they could deduce the distance to Venus and extrapolate the Earth-Sun distance. "I wish them luck," Halley said in laying out his scheme. and pray above all that they are not robbed of the hoped-for spectacle by the untimely gloom of a cloudy sky. Clouds indeed intervened in some places to foil the observations. Even where clear weather prevailed, the hundreds of astronomers who heeded Halley's call failed to achieve precise measurements, so that neither the 1761 transit nor the next one in 1769 yielded the desired result. The great effort and expense did succeed, however, in narrowing the Earth-Sun distance to a range of possibilities somewhere between 90 and 100 million miles. When the transits predicted for 1874 and 1882 again united scientists in the quest for a conclusive determination, Simon Newcomb took charge of American expeditionary preparations. In the run-up to the events, he commissioned the firm Alvin Clark to build instruments and invited Dr. Henry Draper to Washington to teach the several teams how to photograph the sun. In the aftermath, in the 1890s, Newcomb asked Miss Bruce to pay salaries for a staff of computers to reduce the accumulated observations. This process was still in progress when Eros entered the scene, promising to shave many thousands of miles of uncertainty off the long-sought figure. Planning the Eros campaign of 1900 to 1901 mobilized the world's astronomers, though not in the mounting of expeditions. No one needed to go anywhere. Unlike an eclipse or a transit, which transpired in a matter of minutes or hours, the autumn visit of Eros would occupy several months' worth of nights. Observatories throughout Europe, Africa, and across America were already ideally situated and already outfitted with the large telescopes required for sighting a dim, tiny asteroid against a starry backdrop. An international consortium of cooperating astronomers would monitor Eros's changing position in relation to large numbers of reference stars. In the United States, only the Harvard College Observatory was equipped to track Eros by means of photography. The escalating enthusiasm for Eros made Miss Bruce wish that her own asteroid, Brucia, would show herself again. But the time was not right. Miss Bruce's namesake hid far out of sight. Miss Bruce also withdrew. She fell ill again and died at her home in New York on March 13, 1900. It is no easy thing to choose fitting words to refer to the close of any life on Earth, popular astronomy editor William W. Payne wrote in his obituary notice. Much more is it difficult to offer a right and worthy tribute to the memory of one like Miss Catherine Wolfe Bruce, who, for noble cause, the world of science has learned to love for what she was and for what she did. Payne, whose own Goodsell Observatory at Carleton College in Northfield, Minnesota, had once received aid from Miss Bruce, praised her intelligent generosity, which knew no limits of race or country. And so science the world over mourns a common loss. Her kind and thoughtful care lightened many a burden in her own land, awakened new zeal in needful research, and helped to finish many a task when patience and other resources were nearly gone. In closing his brief sketch of her life, Payne itemized the long list of her gifts to astronomy. They totaled more than $175,000, the equivalent of a royal ransom. Part 2. Oh, be a fine girl, kiss me. It was almost as if the distant stars had really acquired speech and were able to tell of their constitution and physical condition. Annie Jump Cannon, 1863 to 1941. Curator of Astronomical Photographs, Harvard College Observatory. The fact that I was a girl never damaged my ambitions to be a pope or an emperor. Willa Cather, 1873 to 1947. Winner of the American Academy of Arts and Letters Gold Medal for Fiction. Chapter 6. Miss Fleming's Title. Mina Fleming's star was on the ascendant. In 1899, at Pickering's urging, the Harvard Corporation formally appointed her to a newly created position as curator of astronomical photographs. She thus became, at age 42, the first woman ever to hold a title at the observatory or the college or the university at large. At this same time, the turning of the century inspired the Harvard administration to assemble a time capsule of campus life. With photographs, publications, essays, and diaries solicited from students, faculty, and staff, Mrs. Fleming dutifully wrote out her contribution for the chest of 1900 over a period of 6 weeks. In the astrophotographic building of the observatory, she began March 1st, 1900, on a lined yellow notepad, 12 women, including myself, are engaged in the care of the photographs. Identification, examination, and measurement of them, reduction of these measurements, and preparation of results for the printer. Every day, they bent to their examination tasks in pairs, one with a microscope or magnifying glass poised over a glass plate in its frame, and the other holding a logbook propped open on a desktop or in her lap, recording the spoken observations of her partner. A hum of numbers and letters, like conversations in code, pervaded the computing room. "The measurements made with the meridian photometer," Mrs. Fleming continued, "are also reduced and prepared for publication in this department of the observatory." Florence Cushman, who had previously worked for a business firm, received the sheaves of magnitude measurements made nightly with photometers in Cambridge and Peru. She and Amy Jackson McKay copied over the visual observer's judgments, calculated the corrections, and checked and rechecked the figures before consigning them to the printer. The rest of the female computing staff, consisting of the sisters Anna and Louisa Winlock, daughters of the previous director, and the ladies who helped them process the data regarding star positions, remained in the west wing of the original observatory, as the brick building's limited space could not accommodate everyone. "From day to day, my duties at the observatory are so nearly alike that there will be but little to describe outside ordinary routine work of measurement, examination of photographs, and work involved in the reduction of these observations." If Mrs. Fleming's days blended in sameness, as she claimed, they bore no resemblance to those of any other invited contributor to the Harvard time capsule. "My home life is necessarily different from that of other officers of the university, since all housekeeping cares rest on me, in addition to those of providing the means to meet their expenses." She had to plan and purchase all provisions, plus give instructions to Marie Hegarty, the Irish maid she retained to clean house and cook the evening meal 6 nights a week. Although Mrs. Fleming was contracted to work 7 hours a day at the observatory, she rarely arrived past 9 a.m. or left before 6 in the evening. "My son, Edward, now a junior in the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, knows little or nothing of the value of money, and therefore has the idea but that everything should be forthcoming on demand." The frugal Mrs. Fleming minimized her expenses by inviting Annie Cannon to board with her on Upland Road. Miss Cannon proved companionable and came from a good family. Her father, Wilson Lee Cannon, was a bank director and former state senator in Delaware. "The first part of this morning at the observatory," Mrs. Fleming reported on March 1st, "was devoted to the revision of Miss Cannon's work on the classification of the bright southern stars, which is now in preparation for the printer." Miss Cannon had picked up the knack for classification much faster than Mrs. Fleming expected. Of course, Miss Cannon enjoyed the advantage of college-level instruction in spectroscopy, as well as several years' experience as an assistant physics teacher and observer, opportunities that had been denied Mrs. Fleming. Still, there was no begrudging Miss Cannon the credit due her for making rapid, accurate evaluations of stellar types. She mirrored Miss Morey's ability to characterize individual lines in the hundreds of bright stellar spectra assigned to her. But she did not insist, as Miss Morey had done, on some altogether new scheme of her own devising. Instead, Miss Cannon abided by Mrs. Fleming's lettered categories. She had, in fact, built a bridge between the two Harvard sorting systems by simplifying Miss Morey's double-tiered division and skewing Mrs. Fleming's alphabetical order. Since both those approaches were arbitrary, founded solely on the appearance of the spectra, Miss Cannon was free to assert her own sense of order. After all, astronomers could not yet tie any given traits of stars, such as temperature or age, to the various groupings of spectral lines. What they needed was a consistent classification, a holding pattern for the stars that would facilitate fruitful future research. Miss Cannon thought it best to move Mrs. Fleming's O stars from the tail end to the top of the list, giving the helium lines precedence over the hydrogen, in the fashion of Miss Morey. B stars likewise ranked ahead of the A in Miss Cannon's appraisal. Beyond those rearrangements, alphabetical order again held sway, except where Miss Cannon conflated certain categories. C, D, E, and a few other class distinctions had fallen away. The resulting order wound up as O, B, A, F, G, K, M. A wag at Princeton later made the string of letters memorable by the phrase, "Oh, be a fine girl, kiss me." Mrs. Fleming's March 1st journal entry continued with the classification of the spectra of the faint stars for the Southern Draper catalog. This was Mrs. Fleming's own province, though she shared the vast territory with Louisa Wells, Mabel Stevens, Edith Gill, and Evelyn Leland. Whereas at the beginning of Mrs. Fleming's career, the faint stars of the northern sky had belonged to her alone, the southern sky could not be managed single-handedly. The observing conditions at Arequipa, for one thing, coaxed many more faint stars out of the dark. On plates made with the Bruce telescope, even ninth magnitude spectra appeared legible enough for the positions of individual lines to be measured. Moreover, any newfound variable necessitated a search through as many as 100 previous plates of the same sky area, taken through the decade in Peru in order to confirm the star's variability. Every year, this part of Mrs. Fleming's work grew more laborious, owing to the ever-richer trove of material for comparison. The numerous discoveries that had brought her such pleasure, such acclaim, so many cuttings in her scrapbook, weighed on her now. Even the director admitted that it had become difficult to amass all the required data for one variable star before another turned up. "The work of measurement is already well advanced," Mrs. Fleming said of the lines in the southern spectra, still on day one in her journal. "And we expect to accomplish much during the coming summer. Professor Bailey's observations with the meridian photometer in South America then came up for examination." Solon Bailey, now back in Cambridge, was writing out the results of his five-year sojourn at Arequipa. His southern magnitudes, or brightness assessments, focused on the multitude of variable stars in star clusters, the cluster variables, as he called them. Glass plates he had taken through the Bache, Boyden, and Bruce telescopes revealed some 500 variables in those stellar agglomerations, and their photographic brightness needed to be rectified with his visual observations. Often he spent the night at the observatory, aiding the director in new observations or supervising one or another of the assistants. The Bailey's 15-year-old son, Irving, whose entire childhood education concerned the natural history and archaeology of the high Andes, now attended the Cambridge Latin School in preparation for entering Harvard College. "Various other pieces of work," claimed Mrs. Fleming's attention during that first morning of record, and in the afternoon, several business matters called her to Boston. Later on, she wrote, I joined Mrs. S.I. Bailey, Miss Anderson, and my sister Mrs. Mackey at the Castle Square Theater. The play was The Firm of Girdlestone, based on Arthur Conan Doyle's 1890 novel of the same name. The Firm of Girdlestone portrayed the deceitful dealings of a failing family-owned business, and we all enjoyed it. Mrs. Bailey tried to persuade me to stop over and dine with her and spend the night, but my little family needs me at home in the morning. They are apt to be late for breakfast and consequently for daily duties, when the head of the house is not there to get them going. The next day at the observatory, March 2nd, Mrs. Fleming devoted herself to miscellaneous odds and ends and a gathering together of loose strands. These included keeping up with the scientific correspondence and sending out copies of the observatory's latest pamphlet, Standards of Faint Stellar Magnitudes No. 2, to all those affiliates, both amateur and professional, who followed the fluctuating brightness of the variable stars. Next in order came Miss Cannon's remarks on the classification of spectra. This is very trying work, as so many things have to be taken into consideration, especially where it is found necessary to change the form of a remark. Each such comment for publication offered a specific, often lengthy description of some aspect of a spectral peculiarity. It took time to make Miss Cannon see why we had changed one thing and questioned another. Miss Cannon's remarks struck Mrs. Fleming as voluminous, threatening to fill a couple dozen double-columned pages of the smallest print. Not even Miss Maury had found it necessary to remark at such length. The end of the day afforded Mrs. Fleming a quiet period for reflection. My small family has deserted me this evening. I am the lodestone left to prevent the house from blowing away. After dinner, Miss Cannon found that the clouds had cleared away and the stars were coming out, so she went over to the observatory to get her observations of the circumpolar variables with the 6-inch telescope. Edward has gone down to study with Mr. Garrett, who is in his section, mining engineering course in tech. Niall Fish, Edward's young friend who has been with us since Christmas night, has gone to make some calls, and I am awaiting Miss Cannon's return. If she gets home early, we may be able to dispose of some of the questions regarding the remarks in her classification. Meanwhile, I must see the Herald and find out from it, if I can, the condition of the Boers and the British in South Africa. Edward talks of going out there when he finishes his course at the Institute. Miss Cannon stayed very late at the telescope that night, which bumped the ongoing discussion of her remarks to the next day, March 3rd, a typical working Saturday at the observatory. Before lunch, Mrs. Fleming found time to examine a few southern spectrum plates. She lamented that supervision of routine procedures left her less and less time for the particular investigations that most interested her, or even to get well settled down for my general classification of faint spectra for the new Draper catalog. Saturday night guests Shay Fleming amused themselves playing India, a form of rummy, Jack Straws, pickup sticks, and the board games Crokinole and Q-Ring. Sometimes a few friends sang for the rest of the company, but if not, there was plenty of pleasant conversation to go around. Mrs. Fleming prepared fudge and dates stuffed with peanuts to serve to a few guests, or for a large soiree, creamed oysters with hot cocoa, cakes, and sweets. Cleaning up and winding down afterward with Edward and Miss Cannon, she might not get to bed till well past midnight. "This is my day of rest and retirement so far as observatory work is concerned," Mrs. Fleming noted Sunday morning, March 4th. "But it brings my only opportunities for investigating the condition of household affairs, and I find the day all too short for them." The linens had to be changed, the family wash gathered for the laundress. Alas, how matter-of-fact and different from the Sunday morning duties of other officers of the university. Turn-of-the-century fervor found William H. Pickering plotting a new scientific adventure. He had recently burnished his international reputation by making a major discovery. In March 1899, he detected a new moon of Saturn orbiting beyond the planet's vast rings. The revelation of a ninth Saturnian satellite put William in a league with the observatory's exalted father and son former directors, the Bonds. Half a century earlier, in September 1848, William Cranch Bond and George Phillips Bond together had uncovered the eighth known moon of Saturn, which they named Hyperion. They had spotted it through the lens of the Great Refractor. William's new moon, like so many other recent findings at the observatory, turned up on Bruce telescope photographs. Although the object was extremely dim, below 15th magnitude, William flushed it from hiding by superposing glass negatives of long exposures taken on successive nights. Only one among the many minuscule grayish dots changed position from image to image. In keeping with the established nomenclature theme of mythological titans for Saturn's attendants, William suggested the name Phoebe, and it stuck. The possibility of another, even more significant discovery fanned William's desire to view the upcoming total solar eclipse on May 28, 1900, which promised to be visible across the southeastern United States. With the sun's light masked by the moon, and the favorable geometry of this particular eclipse, William hoped to discern a planet lying inside the orbit of Mercury. Several astronomers suspected the Sun of harboring a large close companion, or intermercurial planet, and William believed his photography skills sufficient to expose the object. His brother, Edward, who usually frowned on the expense and possible futility of eclipse expeditions, blessed the plan. With the funds allotted, William was building a large camera capable of capturing a dim phantom under twilight conditions. Mrs. Fleming anticipated joining the eclipse party. Examining the eclipse photographs for signs of a planet between the sun and Mercury, though challenging, would probably not differ much from her morning task on March 5th, when she relocated the missing asteroid Fortuna on four recent chart plates. Then, after critiquing some remarks by Professor Wendell, the director's photometry partner, on variable star magnitudes, she grappled again with Miss Cannon's remarks. "This takes more time and concentration of thought than any manuscript I have worked on since we put Miss Maury's volume 28, Part 1, through the printer's hands," she judged. "If one could only go on and on with original work, looking for new stars, variables, classifying spectra, and studying their peculiarities and changes, life would be a most beautiful dream. But you come down to its realities when you have to put all that is most interesting to you aside in order to use most of your available time preparing the work of others for publication. However, whatsoever thou puttest thy hand to, do it well. I am more than contented to have such excellent opportunities for work in so many directions, and proud to be considered of any assistance to such a thoroughly capable scientific man as our director." Throughout her journal, Mrs. Fleming expressed only positive sentiments about Edward Pickering, except on the matter of her remuneration. When she engaged him on March 12th in some conversation about pay, she got no satisfaction. "He seems to think that no work is too much or too hard for me, no matter what the responsibility or how long the hours. But let me raise the question of salary, and I am immediately told that I receive an excellent salary as women's salaries stand. If he would only take some step to find out how much he is mistaken in regard to this, he would learn a few facts that would open his eyes and set him thinking. Sometimes I feel tempted to give up and let him try someone else, or some of the men to do my work, in order to have him find out what he is getting for $1,500 a year from me, compared with $2,500 from some of the other male assistants. Does he ever think that I have a home to keep and a family to take care of as well as the men? But I suppose a woman has no claim to such comforts, and this is considered an enlightened age." For a week following that expression of frustration, Mrs. Fleming felt too tired in the evening to recap her long days. At first, she thought this failure due to laziness, which with me would be something heretofore unknown. It turned out to be the onset of the grip, which soon confined her to bed, weak and feverish. When her son came down with the same contagious complaint, their doctor put them both on a regimen of beef tea. As Marie, the domestic, also fell sick, too sick to tend them or even repair to her own home, the doctor found a temporary caretaker for all three patients. Miss Cannon remained well and continued her nightly observation of the circumpolar variables. She divided her days between the glass plates in the brick building and the holdings of the observatory's library, where she engaged in new paperwork the director entrusted to her. She now had charge of maintaining a card catalog of vital statistics on variable stars. This resource, begun in 1897 by a former assistant, already consisted of 15,000 cards listing every published reference to the approximately 500 known variables, culled from bulletins, journals, and reports of observers all over the world. Miss Cannon could read both French and German, the other two languages of science. She fattened the decks of cards in the existing bibliography and created new card files as new variables came to light. In mid-April, when Mrs. Fleming fully recovered her strength and no longer needed to take a carriage to the observatory, she reviewed her time capsule diary with a pang of contrition. "I find that on March 12th, I have written at considerable length regarding my salary. I do not intend this to reflect on the director's judgment, but feel that it is due to his lack of knowledge regarding the salaries received by women in responsible positions elsewhere. I am told that my services are very valuable to the observatory, but when I compare the compensation with that received by women elsewhere, I feel that my work cannot be of much account." Edward Pickering highly valued the accomplishments and industry of Mrs. Fleming. Indeed, he planned to nominate her for the 1900 Bruce Medal. Who better? In view of the important part taken by women in American astronomy, he reasoned, and given the fact that the Bruce Medal had been established by a woman, it seemed only natural that the honor be bestowed on the woman who had made the greatest number of important astronomical discoveries to date, namely, Mrs. W.P. Fleming of Harvard. The recent and much regretted passing of Miss Bruce, who had explicitly opened the award to women, seemed to underscore Pickering's argument, and he hoped the other members of the prize committee would agree to see things his way. Some resistance was to be expected, of course, just as the Harvard Corporation had resisted, for a time, his idea of conferring the curator title on Mrs. Fleming. The men of the corporation had similarly balked at his suggestion that they appoint Mrs. Draper to the observatory's visiting committee. But eventually, they relented and she became its first female member. Mrs. Draper's frequent visits to the observatory, with or without the excuse of a committee meeting, always cheered her. She loved seeing the Draper Memorial work in progress and took interest in the other projects as well. In the spring of 1900, she expressed the desire to accompany the upcoming Harvard expedition to observe the May 28th eclipse. She had experienced only one total solar eclipse, that of 1878, but without actually seeing it, owing to her voluntary seclusion in the tent where she counted out the seconds of totality. This time, she would have nothing to do but view the phenomenon in the pleasant company of her personal guests, Edward and Lizzie Pickering, along with Mrs. Fleming and Miss Cannon. The director had not meant to join the eclipse party, as he was not needed for the planned observations and therefore could not justify the added expense. However, Mrs. Draper's magnanimous invitation changed his mind. She made all the travel arrangements. Railroad tickets, boat accommodations, the hotel rooms in Norfolk and Savannah, even a book for Pickering to read on the way down called Confessions of a Thug. Originally published in 1839, this novel by Philip Meadows Taylor purported to be the true account of an assassin belonging to the Thuggee cult in India. You will find it full of horrors, she promised. It might make good reading for a steamer. It is sufficiently thrilling to keep one interested and is a page of history. At the chosen viewing site in Washington, Georgia, the Harvard groups converged with astronomers from MIT and from Percival Lowell's Flagstaff Observatory. The weather did not disappoint. William Pickering set up his special camera, which looked like a huge box, 11 feet long and 7 wide, with 4 lenses of 3-inch aperture arrayed to capture the intermercurial panorama. When the partial phase of the eclipse began, around 12:30, Mrs. Draper and the others avoided looking directly at the sun in order to protect their eyes from injury. But at the cry of totality, about an hour later, they all looked up to drink in the sight. Where the midday sun had blazed, an eerie reversal now deepened the color of the sky and cast a sudden chill over the observers. The dark face of the new moon hung like a great black hole overhead, surrounded by the glimmering fringe of the sun's corona. The corona, invisible under normal conditions, extended its platinum-colored streamers as though reaching out to the planets Mercury and Venus, which now came into view against the background of crepuscular blue. The strange, beautiful vision commandeered the senses for a full minute. Then, as the moon continued moving in its orbit, a blinding shaft of sunlight shot through a gap in the mountains on the lunar limb, signaling the end of the event. I shall always be glad that I have seen a total solar eclipse, Mrs. Draper wrote Pickering on May 30th, 1900. Simply as a spectacle, it is magnificent, and as the Chief Justice remarked, it gave one a distinct thrill. William's camera arrangement allowed him to make 36 plates of the eclipse. Unfortunately, none of the pictures yielded satisfaction, because someone inadvertently disturbed the instrument during the brief totality. The AROS campaign, the global effort to observe the newly discovered asteroid, proved more successful for Harvard. The privileged position of the Bruce Telescope in the Southern Hemisphere enabled Delisle Stewart at Arequipa to take some excellent photographs a month before the asteroid became visible anywhere else. Officially, Pickering cooperated with some 50 observatories worldwide to ascertain positions of AROS in the attempt to derive the Sun-Earth distance. Personally, however, he found the asteroid's changing light even more intriguing. Viennese astronomer Egon von Oppolzer had shown AROS to be as variable in brightness as many a variable star, and Pickering hoped to construct its definitive light curve. He recalled that when Mrs. Fleming first retrieved the AROS plates, she had pointed out slight brightness variations in the asteroid's trail. At the time, he attributed the irregularity to patches of haze in the intervening air. Now he recognized other possibilities. AROS might prove to be a rotating body with surface features of dramatic contrast, or perhaps a pair of two small bodies of differing complexion tumbling around each other. Beginning in July 1900, Pickering directed the Cambridge Chief of Photography, Edward Skinner King, to make plates of AROS every clear evening through the 8-inch Draper telescope. Inside the dome of the Great